Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 229, featuring Jose Perega Gomez and Marco Margueta of ZHA, better known as Zaha Hadid Architects. Jose and Marco were absolutely great. They were guests of ours and speakers at Total Chaos 2019, which happened earlier in May. It was really great to have them there, which is exactly where I recorded this podcast with them, which was really cool. And I really appreciate them coming on. We talked a whole lot about, you know, what ZHA does and, you know, what is Patrick doing now with all the different technologies that are being used in architecture. Obviously, Zaha Hadid herself, you know, really embraced technology, really embraced computer graphics back in the early 90s. So she's always had that legacy of doing that. And to see how things have changed in these many, many years since those early days, I really think it was fantastic to hear about it, to hear about all the different tools that they use. There's a lot of very interesting things that they do. Obviously, they've evolved as computer graphics have evolved, and they've always stayed at the cutting edge to the point where they develop a lot of their own software, and they integrate with lots of different types of software. So one of the biggest challenges they do is try to keep all the data live between all these different applications, which is also a really interesting way to operate, and a big problem, honestly, in computer graphics and how to solve that. We talk a lot about the different tools they use and some of the tools that they have to use, like Revit, and how that can, you know, not necessarily be very conducive to designs that come out of ZHA. But it was just a really fascinating conversation. So I really appreciate both of them coming by and doing this podcast. It was really fascinating to hear about all the different work that they do. Don't have much of announcements. Actually, no, I do have some announcements. I'm sorry. I have been on vacation, everybody, and I just got back. So this is the first time I've been back since vacation, and it was a really great time. But since I've been gone, there have been several announcements that you guys probably should know about. The first being that there's V-Ray Next 4 3ds Max has an update too, and there's a lot of great new features there. So go to chaosgroup.com and find out about those features. And we even have an update for V-Ray for Unreal, update 1. So that is actually got a lot of new features in there as well, including native support for Unreal Materials, which is a new thing that we've done now, which is really cool. And lots of things that you can look at in that area, and baking, and just go to our website, go check it out, go look at, go to the product pages for V-Ray for Unreal and V-Ray for 3ds Max, and check out the What's New section, and you'll be able to see all the new features that are there, and it's really cool to have that. So just want to make sure you guys check that out. I don't have any other big announcements besides those two things. So with that being said, please enjoy this fantastic podcast with Jose and Marco from ZHA.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Yeah, I mean, I think your offices are very interesting. Since the earliest days, I actually met Zaha briefly at a conference when I was at a talk she gave in Houston. Mm-hmm. And one of the funniest things I remember, because she was so into technology and using it from the earliest days of this stuff, and people were just like, I don't understand how these people use computers for architecture. But she embraced it, obviously, very early. And obviously, the offices have since flourished in that area. But I really want to think to talk about how you guys think about technology nowadays, that it's become such commonplace for people to do. You guys were trailblazers back in the early days, but now you guys are like have to stay way ahead of it and start to think about technology very differently in terms of what you're doing and, you know, using computers in that way. So how has things changed since, you know, back when I met her in 96?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on how you define technology is avant-garde.
Right.
Because if, I mean, if you look back to 96, it was basically, you know, pretty much anything that you do with the computer was already, you know, being at least ahead of the curve, right?
Right.
At this point, most people are well-versed with most softwares.
Right.
But very few, at least very few architectural offices go beyond that, right? So trying
right.
to extend their software packages or even just trying to incorporate technologies such as VR, AR, as all this stuff that is kind of new, and most offices are a bit afraid of engaging so fast into the technology. They wait a little bit for it to mature.
Right.
So something that our office tends to do is that it's just filled of people that are enthusiastic about. Or there's a few people here and there that have interest in these sort of areas.
Right.
So what happens is that one of them finds interesting to start developing plugins for Maya.
Right.
And then you have a group of people that basically start doing this sort of stuff on a daily basis, right? So that's
so
how
you
we
guys
drive.
Are developing your own software in a lot of ways, right?
At least extending it.
Yes. Yeah. So to add on what Hosse said, we had already a long time, or it's now 10 years, one R&D group mm-hmm. called ZH Code, mm-hmm. which is my department. That was established back then by Niels Fischer, Sharjay Boshan, and Patrick himself.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last years, then we had ZH VR mm-hmm. and ZH BIM, which mm-hmm. is Revit, and they're also developing their own plugins to mm-hmm. make it easy to transfer.
Right.
But also now we have ZH AI, which is ZH, not artificial intelligence, it's analytics, and
okay.
ZH AB. Agent-based parametric semiology, ABPS.
Wow.
So, as you can see, we have a lot of R&D, small R&D departments that explore different stuff across the field.
Right.
So, for example, the agent-based parametric semiology mm-hmm. Department is actually using agents, and we are trying to measure in a virtual world how they feel about space.
Okay, so to explain what your agents are.
So, well, the agents are an object,
right.
let's say. But it's basically points that move through a virtual space, but they have then certain angle of view and so on.
Okay.
And they interact with each other.
It's similar to a massive simulation in a way, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. So right. it's a little bit like Sims, just more complicated.
Right.
And the same is, for example, with analytics. They're analyzing office spaces and seeing where in our designs, where it could be potential more flow, where it would be more silent spaces, and they then recommend certain areas to put tables or so. So there's a lot of stuff going actually behind the scene, and we are trying to use also AI
right.
to figure out new ways or new smarter spaces and so on. So we are heavily investing in R&D
right.
on the side.
So it sounds like you're basically using a lot of tools to help decisions in design, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, basically, all these different groups, like their agenda is find different ways of interrogating our own designs, right? So that during the design process,
right.
while we're developing this design, we have some tools to sort of objectively evaluate whether we're in the right or the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And we can make a case then to our clients saying, well, the reason why we make this decision is because there is this evidence, right, that this design works in this sense.
Okay, that's an interesting idea because going back again to the 90s, there was a lot of people that were using very interesting tools. So it started off with just like, I'm going to use CAD to do the things that I already know how to do, like drafting.
Yeah.
But then they were like, I'm going to use computers to just, had a podcast with Greg Lynn where he's like, you know, it was the time of happy accidents, right?
Yeah.
Where you create some weird stuff and it's like, I like it. And then you just make a building that is out of that. Those days are gone now. A lot of people don't do that anymore. So now you almost have to feel like you're using your analysis to justify the decisions that you're making along the way, right?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you have to make a case for why, especially ourselves that are very invested in competitions. So we have to make a lot of cases as to why our design is better than other design.
Uh-huh.
And in some cases, it's just how our design is better than our previous design, right?
So, right.
We need to somehow be able to put that in words that make sense to a client that is not necessarily invested in the technology or is not familiar on the way we develop our designs.
And how do they respond to that?
It depends on how many competitions we win, right?
Right.
It's hard for me to tell you.
Right.
Anyway, these tools are going to continue to develop further, right? So at
right.
the moment, where they are very rough around the edges.
Right.
We're hoping in a few years these tools become something that is that there's no doubt, right, that right. this is actually something that makes sense, right? So there's a lot of development on that side. We're also very invested in, heavily invested in VR and okay. AR. So we use a lot of this also to interrogate our designs, right? So we try to use it as early as we can and see, you know, find all the problems that we can from the very beginning.
Right.
As well as find opportunities where we can design using the technology, right?
Okay.
So, yeah.
VR much. Obviously has become, you know, there's a, it's interesting because VR has actually become an integral part of architecture at this point. Everyone is investing in it because it actually makes the most sense, right? Yeah. If you can try to justify VR as the next filmmaking platform, I don't necessarily feel that's the case. But for architecture, it's like, well, it's completely natural because it is where you, basically it's, you're looking at something that doesn't exist yet, right? That's exactly what you're doing in VR in some way.
Yeah, and also one thing is, especially I would say our office is massaging designs forever. So
right.
we are pushing vertices for like days and days.
Uh-huh.
And the problem is with 3ds Max, Maya, and whatever tool you use, you right. often just toggle around the building, but you are hardly really inside to see how it feels from a human perspective.
Right.
And that is something that also VR actually helps to stay inside and see what you actually done from the human
scale.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So scale is one of the most important things, I guess, for you guys.
Yeah. I mean, we have certain projects that are actually very large scale that are very hard to understand while you're designing it, while you're looking just to the screen.
Right.
Right. So it's a very useful check for you to make sure that you're making a design that makes sense, that
mm-hmm.
or where you're trying to make a case, for example, we're developing a building in China that has the largest atrium, right?
Right.
So being able to evaluate those kind of designs from an eye perspective,
mm-hmm.
it's much different from seeing this in a 2D screen in a Maya or in a 3D
right.
Max environment or even in a render, right? The render, as realistic as it can be, just doesn't have a sense of scale as VR does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I remember back when I was an intern at Fox and Fowle Architects, and we were still doing physical models at that
right.
time. And I was working on a building, and we had a physical model, and it was about, I don't know, about half a meter high, right? And we had this building, and then there's another model that was the lobby space for the number 4 Times Square that they were doing. And it was about the same height and stuff, and then we realized, do you guys realize that those are actually the same scale model? And we were like, that's how big that lobby is? But you would never have
yeah.
known.
Yeah.
If you were in VR, you could basically go, oh, that is a 10-story lobby.
Yeah.
It's a huge area, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So I think that you're right. And when you look at it in VR, you start to say, oh, wow, that is really big. Or, whoa, that hallway is too narrow or
yeah,
whatever
it
is.
Like it doesn't work.
Right.
And other things that you can do in VR that you just can't do in physical world. Right? So, for example, being able to scale the building down, scale the building up, right? Toggle
right.
between these scales. Like it just helps you bypass that process of having to make a physical model so you can evaluate different,
sure.
you know, the different dimensions of your building when you can toggle basically the whole model, treat it as if it was a physical model.
Now, do you guys build and model and design inside of VR or do you basically just use VR to look at what you're doing?
It depends on the scale.
Okay.
So what we found so far, our VR group within the office is relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like we have the resources to try this on a huge project, for example.
Right.
But so far,
it's not like every designer has a VR headset at their desk.
No, that would be the ideal, but I think we're a few years away from that.
Yeah, I don't.
If that ever happens.
Right, yeah.
Right. But say things like furniture design,
mm-hmm.
that is something we have used VR for, right?
Okay.
So design an object that is relatively limited in size, that is either the human scale or a table scale.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that is great. And we've used pretty much any software out there in terms of VR modeling, like Medium, Masterpiece VR, Gravity Sketch,
right.
MindDisk, to see which one sort of fits best when it comes to our design. And Gravity Sketch has worked great for us when it comes to assuming that your model is actually going to go through a fabrication stage at some point.
Okay.
So be able to fabricate in that sense, it actually makes a lot of...
Right.
Yeah, and it's a completely different medium, so your result is actually different.
Right. So VR is actually right. VR is actually, I didn't think about it in terms of furniture, but it's ideal for furniture as well.
It is. It is. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, what are some of the other interesting tools that you guys have been working along the way with? You mentioned some of the simulation stuff.
Yeah, like, well, in my department, we are also heavily in, like, trying to find special structural cases. So we have also shell analysis or something that we use to find really thin concrete structures or something that we can then run on top of Maya or Rhino. Yeah, we have a lot of also libraries for different frameworks. If it's C++ or C sharp.
Right.
And so on. So, and some tools actually then secure also to all the employees. Some are quite specific, so they stay there. But yeah, I'm in general we have a lot of smaller like scripts and collections.
How many developers do you guys have working on tools?
Well, our department is 10, but we are not really spending the time to, like, a tool comes maybe as a byproduct of a project.
Got it.
So it's not like a full on. So the whole R&D teams are maybe 30 people, probably maybe 16 something in the BIM, 10 in
right.
We are project funded, most of us. So what that basically means is as we are working on a project, we are developing something on the side that is meant to help on that project, but then may evolve into something else.
Well, that's smart.
Yeah.
because you're a service industry after all, you know, so.
Yeah. No, and at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is build a knowledge base for the office to use, right? So for example, we've built tools that allow us, by now there must be plenty of tools out there that do the same thing, but for example, about 10 years ago, we started developing tools that allowed us to transfer geometry between Rhino and Revit while keeping geometry alive. I don't know if that makes sense, keeping geometry native.
Okay.
Right. So something like that that was developed for a specific project, that basically the workflow that goes from Grasshopper directly to Revit, transferring lines and points and then converting them on the other side to families and walls and these kind of elements. That is a knowledge that was then transferred to a different project and enhanced, another project enhanced, and this library has kept growing. And now there's a BIM group that uses this to try to solve the most of our projects in that way, so that we try to keep a BIM model that makes sense, that is alive, that is native, that is not all the geometry and is only for the information.
Okay. Well, let's talk briefly about BIM, because I'm very curious about how you guys are using that. I find that sometimes BIM does not necessarily a really good facilitator for open-ended design.
Yeah, it's definitely tricky, and you can see definitely in our design teams that our design teams prefer to stay also more in the Maya world or Rhino
or Grasshopper.
Yeah, and then they send it to Revit, and then they figure out, okay, it's not ideal, and then they go a little bit back and forth.
Okay.
Which is why we've developed this tool.
This plugin,
right?
Yeah.
So the reason is because, the project we were developing it for originally, it's a client that has basically changed their mind every 2 weeks regarding the entire design, right? And it's a huge building. It's a 1,000-unit building.
Okay.
So we had to develop a workflow in which we could make quick changes every time the client made a comment, and we didn't have to throw ourselves out the window.
Right.
Right. So basically it was a direct link between Grasshopper and Revit.
Right.
So I would press a button in Grasshopper, somebody else would press a button in Revit, and they would get the native geometry again.
Right. Right. Because otherwise you'd have to start from scratch
exactly.
every time.
Yeah. And every time that you get to a point where there's a design change, you are gonna be reluctant to do it. Right. When the reality is that the end goal of the office is the design.
Right.
Right. Like whether I have to invest 4 weeks or you know, preparing my model so it can go into Revit, like that's definitely not the kind of conversation that I wanna have.
Right.
Yeah, the kind of conversation you wanna have is the lobby nice? Is do I like the way the shape works? If that is not the conversation I'm having, then there's something in between that I need to fix,
right? Yeah.
Which is how some of these tools have come about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we have, to my knowledge, we don't have really design coming out of Revit itself.
Right. That's just the means in which you're going to build it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So it's interesting that because you are obviously such a design-centric studio, right? Mm-hmm. And then that's obviously your DNA. That you have, there's an obligation with BIM at this point. Everyone has to use it, right? So, but you have to find a way to keep yourself very flexible in your design and still be able to connect back to BIM at this point.
Yeah, I think that's anyway one of our strengths, that as we are praising the parametricism and the flexibility, adjustability of projects, that's something that we are working on to keep it across the whole, like, all the workflow.
Right.
So rather, if it's the design itself, if it's then translating to Revit, or even rendering or other parts, it's, the more it's getting connected, interconnected, the better it is, because then we can do some changes in the last minute.
Right.
And still the whole work that comes behind would still be up to date.
Right.
Yeah. Especially in our case, because the nature of our geometry and our process, so we tend to work in Maya a lot, for example.
Yep.
Maya to Revit, there's just no direct path there.
They're very different.
You have to go behind the map.
The only thing common is they both work in 3D.
Yeah. Luckily, we have some people that we have Eckhart. I forgot his last name, I'm sorry. Well, I didn't forget it. It's German, so I can't pronounce it.
Okay.
He's very familiar with Revit API. So what that means is that if at some point I have a geometry that is just, I just can't get it in, right? He's knowledgeable enough that he allows us to have the conversation where, like, what if I just give you a network of points? And if I give you the network of points in this specific order, in this way, with this metadata, would you be able to drop it in? Right?
Okay.
And that allows then our plugin to be customized to these very complicated geometries that most architects just don't have to deal with.
Right.
And that means that Autodesk has no interest in solving. You know what I mean? Because us being such a niche design office, what happens is that Autodesk, our very specific issues, they are just not intending to address.
They're only specific to you.
Yeah, they're very specific to us and to a very few set of offices around the world, which means that these are issues that we have to get around ourselves.
Well, I wish it would be the case, because I think there should be more designs like yours around the world. Instead, everyone is making things that just look like they came out of Revit, you know?
comes with some pain.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand. I mean, so it's cool. You guys are still very much, Maya is still a big part of what you guys do, right?
Yeah. I guess Maya just established back in the days as a great tool because, people back then were experimenting with all the animation functions and see, okay, how can we use it for architecture? So, for example, the blend shape thing, where you can morph from one mesh.
Yep.
So normally, they were intended to make the characters for the mouth movement. Yeah. But we thought, cool, like it's a nice feature. Maybe we can apply it on a facade to get like this all morphs, like in holes, like with this pattern, which you see quite often in our projects, where you have smaller holes that then in the fall off go to bigger ones or the other way.
Right.
So those were basically blend shape functions. And we played a lot with these things and in some way abused animation tools for architecture.
I wouldn't say abused.
It's like not originally intended, creatively used, let's say it like that way. And yeah, that's how it established. And also back then, I think Maya and Mel was fairly simple. There was no Grasshopper.
Right.
And
you were using Mel scripts to basically do things that you would do in Grasshopper?
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah,
Grasshopper lowered the bar for pretty much everyone that wanted to jump into producing either scripts and, you know, or programming in a way.
Right.
In quotes.
Quote unquote, yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, but the good thing is that the fact that you lower the bar means that now everybody has new ideas on how to use this tech. So luckily now we have pretty much everybody in the office has a decent knowledge of Grasshopper. Some people are very, very good at Grasshopper in the office, which just like Maya did back then, now this brings new ideas.
I think it's interesting when sometimes the tools, like, just you can see the tool in the design so much sometimes. And I think in the early days of Grasshopper, you could see people and someone goes, they just try it for the first time. It's like, that looks great.
Attractive.
And then it's like the defaults of everything, right?
Yeah. Mm.
And so you see a lot of Grasshopper buildings that look like
Grasshopper
buildings.
Yeah, you know exactly which component is or which number in the sliders was adjusted.
I think my coworker Lon was joking. He's like, I think he was in Boulder, Colorado, and he says, it's the town that was built by SketchUp.
Yeah, that's in America. SketchUp popular. That's
quite
true.
Popular. But I think it's great that, I mean, if you guys diversify on your tools, right, and you start looking at different things, and you start making your own tools, then suddenly your tools become part of your design, right?
Something that I think our office has been doing pretty well for the past 20, 30, like forever, is that because it's so well embedded in academia. So yeah. Patrick has his studios in the AA, in DRL, in Vienna. What happens is that the guys in Vienna and the guys in DRL, they don't have an agenda. They can basically just go on and play for a year, gather a huge amount of expertise on a very specific set of tools, just have happy accidents along the way.
Right.
And then what happens is that the office is, gathers a lot of these people at the end of their postgraduate. So what happens is that then that knowledge becomes part of the office knowledge.
Right.
And so it's an amazing generator of new ideas, because what happens is that every year you have a new generation, and this new generation has something new.
Right.
Like among those guys, there is someone there that has a new idea.
Right.
And I think that's something very unique to the way that Saha operates. I'm pretty sure there are a few other offices in the world that do the same thing, but what it
not
what
to that lot, extent.
Yeah, not to the extent that probably every architecture in the office in the world should be, in one way or in another, invested in academia, because that's really where you get new ideas. So otherwise you end up doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because there's so many people, especially students, right? They go to school, they go to architecture school, they go to grad school for architecture, whatever it is. And that is their time to really experiment with a lot of different things. Mm. I mean, I remember having seen Zaha's talk back in the early 90s and, you know, what was going on. And that's when I decided, and that's dissimilar from your blend shapes. I went in, it's like, I think I'm going to start seeing what I can do with metaballs, you know?
Yeah, for example, yeah.
Right? I was like, maybe metaballs is something interesting to come out of that, or how am I going to use that as a tool?
Yeah.
And then I made, you know, that was my thesis, was all actually done with metaballs at that time. But then the problem is that they go into the architecture firm and then they're stuck with Revit, you know, and then it stifles the design process in a lot of way.
Yeah, I mean, luckily our office, I reckon, encourages us to an extent. It's not like you get like, fine, do whatever you want.
You have to make a building after.
At the end of the day, we have submissions and we have deadlines and we have to fulfill them. But in between, we are encouraged to an extent to just, you know, grab an idea and run with it.
Right.
Right.
Well, so, okay, so there is that moment. So let's you know, to give an example, like in the early days when Frank Gehry was doing his stuff, right? Now, he actually wasn't using computers at all for the design process. He was using just modeling, right? So, but then he would say, build this, right? So he would take the thing, and they didn't have Revit back then, so they did everything in CATIA, which is also an interesting idea, like finding something that can figure out how to build it. So it sounds like what you guys are doing is you guys are creating crazy stuff out of the parameterization that you guys are doing, using the AI tools, all these different tools are doing, but then trying to find a thing that cohesively goes in and then putting it into Revit, which is now, I guess, what they were using CATIA for. So all those tools to try to make that is pretty interesting.
Yeah, in the end, our final product, to say so, that what we're producing is a building.
Right.
So at some point it gets stuck in this documentation or more documenting softwares.
Yeah.
Right.
Either if it's now Revit or we use also CATIA in the office.
Yeah. So I mean, at some point we were looking at BIM and as the new technology, as how can you, you know, use this for your advantage, but at this point it's no longer an option.
No.
It's in the contract. You have to make a BIM model whether you want it or not.
Right.
So
that's right. Now, like the construction now, they almost require BIM.
Yeah,
right?
It's by law partially in some countries.
And depends on the contract how deep that BIM needs to be, right? Whether that BIM needs to be the exact model that you're going to use for fabrication, or you're just going to use it to produce to the documentation. That is also said in the contract, which means that how much pain you have to endure to be able to do all this translation depends exactly on the client. So it's not really like you have a choice of decide whether you want to go to BIM or not.
Right.
Like you want to be an architect, you have to.
You have to use BIM.
Figure it out.
Yeah. It's interesting that now it's by law, right? It's not just a bunch of blueprints in some place. Now it's a full live model that people use as just the maintenance of the building in some cases, right?
And I think we have some, obviously we have examples of, I will reckon, failed attempts of getting a proper BIM to work, and we have some successful attempts. So I believe it's the station in Riyadh that we're developing, where every little panel is produced directly natively in Revit, and they are very complicated panels. So having something like that work properly it just takes you miles along the way, because otherwise that would have been weeks of somebody figuring out a way to input geometry into data, into Revit, which is just wasted time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to. And then so a lot of times when that happens, when it's really complicated, you end up simplifying your design just to make your life easier.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's a sacrifice.
Yeah,
for
it's a loss. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we also push our consultants.
Right.
It's like, no, or like, we want to have it like that, and let's try to figure it out together.
Right.
And then also the structure engineers. I mean, a lot of them are motivated because it's also for them a challenge.
Right.
And then they're motivated. Okay, yeah, let's try to solve this interesting shape that maybe doesn't perform immediately ideal, but you find maybe a compromise, or you find a new idea, like a slightly tweaked but performs way better.
Right.
So it's challenging for the consultants, but also then motivating.
Do you feel that when you go back and forth with your consultants on stuff like that, sometimes as you come up with a difficult design idea, or and it's a challenge in the structure, for example, do you find that sometimes the back and forth, they would communicate back an idea of a structure that's innovative, that that can, albeit changes your design slightly, and then you actually create a better design from the process of the structure? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, sometimes it also evolves.
Right.
They, like, either we come up really with a new like system that doesn't exist yet.
Right.
So that happened in a few projects. And sometimes, yeah, they come with their input and it's all, oh, yeah, actually, that works, or that fits in our agenda and whatever we want to communicate with the building or with the design.
Yeah.
And then we also integrate that and adapt it.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky to work with really good engineering offices.
Okay.
So it not only, you know, the actual result of the design is good because of this, but also they helped us also enhance our process.
Right.
So again, going back to this parametric way of developing.
Right.
We've had buildings where the entire building is Grasshopper, and the model that the people that use for developing their structural design is the same Grasshopper. So basically, if you have to make a change, when you make a change, the structure also updates, right? There's this back and forth where it's not like you decided to move this, now I have to go back to the drawing board for another 2 weeks to fix back. Right. All this is streamlined, which, again, it makes everybody less reluctant to actually take risks and to make design decisions that are tough to make.
Right.
Right? Because of the fact of having this.
It sounds like you guys spend a lot of time making things that are live updating themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're pushing definitely further and further just to make it easier also for our design teams to have it integrated.
Right.
So that they can see, okay, if I push this vertex in that direction, what happens with the structure or something.
Right.
It all depends on the stage, I suppose. Because early stages, when you're in Maya, you want to be free of all these constraints and not think about making something parametric. Right? You just want to pull vertices and make something look good.
Right.
But then at some point, you just say, okay, I reckon this goes in the right direction.
Right.
Now let's make a parametric version of this.
Right.
And then that pays off at the end, because then you can do a lot of stuff on the site. So we have, for example, engineering offices that say, okay, now that we have the Grasshopper model, what if we do a VR model that is attached to the Grasshopper?
Right.
Which means that then you have the entire process all sort of talking to the same parametric version.
Right.
Of the building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. It's brilliant. Let's talk. I want to change subjects a little bit and talk about visualization, right? So one of the most, during my podcast with Patrick, one of the most interesting things he said, which is counter to what every other architect has ever said, is that he believes that you should go right to photorealism in your design process. And there was because a lot of architects like, don't make it look too real because I don't want people to think that it's a done design.
Yeah.
But his argument was they should see how it really looks from the beginning and not try to pretend that it's not there in some way.
Yeah.
And it was a very interesting philosophy. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, that was actually quite funny because I also was more the common, like I had also first the common thinking that, yeah, if you do a render or also for other architectural companies,
right,
you would try to make it to try to sell an emotion, a feeling, how that might feel.
Right.
Like make a good advertisement. And also my Charge Potion, the head of my department, when we were discussing visualizations, how do we approach it? He also mentioned, yeah, well, like we should show every screw, we should show every detail, construction detail immediately at the beginning.
Right.
Because we want to stay as true as possible to the design, so the client can really see what he's get.
Right.
And it was just funny because, yeah, like when I first thought of it, it didn't make sense. But now, yeah, it makes excellent sense because you can also start to, because now it's maybe also not enough just to have a complex shape and to sell, okay, yeah, that looks amazing. But maybe you can start really design, right, what normal architects are also doing, designing details mm-hmm. and use them as an artistic thing. I think we maybe neglected that a little bit before.
Okay.
We had the nice general shape, but maybe some details weren't resolved well. But now we can really try also to resolve small things and try to get, let's say, the parametrics or the nice things or designs also in a smaller scale.
Right.
And that way get it more real. And also something which is maybe also a little bit difficult is if the building looks really like out of space, it's maybe for a person also difficult to imagine how it would look real. So if you try to already show it in photorealism, let's say,
right,
then it's maybe also easier for the client to, okay, yeah, that looks buildable and that looks believable.
So the big concern, and I'm actually going to talk, you know, I want you to defend this because I agree with you, but the big concern that everyone always has is that if you're in an early design process and you show something that looks photoreal, the client feels like, oh, you're done with the design, mm-hmm. right? And so that's their argument, is like, don't show it to make it look too real, make it look like a sketch or do whatever. You know, they try all these tricks to do it so that the client doesn't freak out, apparently, right? Mm. How do you educate a client not to freak out about that process and say, no, this isn't the final design, it just gives you a very good idea of what it's going to look like?
Yeah, we in a lot of cases, we, especially now, for example, in master plans or something, we try to show also that we have parametric model. That mm-hmm. means if he suddenly changes his mind, or for a master plan, let's say he cannot own, like he cannot purchase the land in the end.
Right.
We can still show, okay, actually we are selling a model that can adapt to whatever you need.
Right.
And so we use visualization, of course, to make it look nice, but we also show that we are flexible. We can...
So, two renderings.
Yeah. Two or
yeah, so you can show like two different designs or multiple designs, all of which look photoreal, and that way they realize like, oh, there's not a final decision. It's just, that's just the way.
I mean, it also, I mean, there's at least with our clients, there's an understanding. It looks photoreal from here,
right?
You know what I mean? If you rotate, then there's still unresolved things. So you wanna show your design at the best as it would actually look. To be honest, most of our buildings, they look a bit out of space, not because the model is not realistic, but because the design is a bit out of space.
Yeah.
Right? So when you try to, when we make ourselves renderings that are kind of abstract for, mm-hmm. for certain clients, that is actually, it's hard to get an idea of how that is, it's actually a building. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Yes, I can understand that.
Like a project like our Baku project, for example.
Right.
Right? Like it's a project that on the renders themselves, it looked completely out of space, and it turns out that build looks the same as it did in the renders back then.
Right.
And the renders back then were actually quite abstract and like you would say, very conceptual.
Right.
Yeah, I am completely for going full photorealistic from the beginning,
right.
Not only for the client, but for within the design team.
Right.
Like for me, it makes a lot of sense that when you are designing, you're taking a look at this and thinking this is a building.
Right.
Some people would make and I recognize it's a valid argument that starts constraining your design a little bit, but I reckon being able to visualize the thing as it would actually be, it already makes you interrogate certain things such as scale, as materiality, right?
Right.
That are usually things that you just leave all the way towards the end, especially our office when it comes to start actually assigning materials and textures. Like that's something that we tend to start evaluating, I would reckon, too late in the design.
Yeah, also something which is interesting is talking about textures. For example, wood has a certain directionality.
Yep.
So you might want to use that as a design. Mm-hmm. So let's say we have like a surface that is in hexagon panels or something.
Okay.
And you could, of course, place the wood panels the grain could all look random, or you could actually design the directionality of the grain for following a vector field or something.
Right.
Because now the fabrication methods are so advanced, and for a robot, actually, it doesn't matter how he places the panel for cutting.
Right.
If it's rotated 620 degrees, it doesn't matter. So you can get this precision actually running. So you can start adding detail and really nice aesthetics into macro level, which maybe wasn't so easy before. And if we do it really photorealistic, so we plan those things out, we can just get way more value out of it.
It's interesting. I want to get back to visualization at some point, but now that you brought up fabrication, that's something obviously that you guys have been very familiar with, right? Because you guys are creating things that aren't standard construction. It's not like you can go to Home Depot and make a a CHA building, right? So, but how do you guys work with fabrication? Obviously, there's a lot of stuff that you guys are doing in that area.
Yeah, so like my department, for example, is more in small scale and experimenting with fabrication. So we are a lot into 3D printing.
Mm-hmm.
Or recently we did a nice sculpture in Mexico in cooperation with Block Research Group from ETH.
Okay.
Where actually instead of a wooden foam work where you pour concrete on top, we actually use textile. It's like the textile and the concrete was developed by ETH, and that's also quite fascinating because, like, they argue basically that instead of having a heavy foam work, you can basically take your foam work in a hand luggage, take it in the airplane, and put it somewhere else on. And
because it's fabric,
it's lightweight, and the sculpture was then a really thin concrete shell. But it was poured on that, so it's an interesting way, and they are now trying to make it in a larger scale.
Interesting.
So there is a lot of like experimental fabrication that we have access to, and where we can like experiment based on collaborations.
Right. Well, that's really cool because I think that, you know, obviously concrete is such a you know, it's a liquid that turns solid, right? So it's a very interesting thing. And it's been done so for so long, like you said, with just wooden slats that you just pour this concrete in, and you don't have flexibility when the form that you pour your concrete in is not flexible, right? But now, if you think about doing things like fabric or other forms, and you can create some really interesting concrete shapes, which is cool as well. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about visualization. What are some of the other things? I mean, obviously, we talked about photorealism, but what are some of the other things you guys look at when you're looking at visualization that really help your design process?
One thing that we also try to somehow get running is also to have this parametric visualization so that we can, like, that our renders update with whatever we change in the design.
Right.
Of course, now with V-Ray increasing the investment into Grasshopper, it will be easier for us also.
Okay.
But we have some internal workflows that actually then bakes out the data, auto-imports it then into Maya or Max, so we can work in Grasshopper or another scripting-based design, and we can just, with a few clicks, we can translate and update it also render-wise, or the render scene.
Right.
So the environment of the rendering would update, would change.
Okay.
Or like materials, assignments, and so on, or everything would be automated. So that also leaves the designers maybe more time to focus on the design and less about the visualization directly. So there will be always manual tweaking, of course.
So, but again, it sounds like you, and this seems like a pattern, which is great. Your visualization is basically something that updates itself.
Partially, like we are trying to
think. I mean, when you're working on a large project, like a master plan, I mean, in a smaller case, you may get away with it, but things like master plans, like populating trees, populating cars, populating people, blah, blah, blah. These things that make your master plan actually look, to an extent, photorealistic. Like this,
and to
this
scale.
And to scale, yeah. These are tasks that take a long time if it's something that you're going to do for a once in a, and that's it, right? You're finished. The idea is that, especially when we work in these kind of projects that are changing all the time, those things that can relatively easily be parameterized can also be translated to other software. So you send particles to 3D Max that update the proxies for the trees, for example. So you update on the one side, it updates on the other side. And Marco here is one of the guys that is developing all these plugins that the entire office uses that are for basically just building viewports that allow us to populate with basically interact with all our library of assets, all our which is quite extensive, like all the people, all the trees, all the cars, the brands of the cars, all this information that we have in the office that is relatively hard to find when you have to go to a folder structure and you need to import the tree for this specific climate. So basically what he's done is that he's built a UI that allows us to simply go through all of this. And then, so we have our live model on the one side that has the position for all these elements. And then we have our library that allows us to select from these elements with relative ease. And this makes the entry barrier for everybody that wants to do visualizations within the office a lot lower than it would be if you don't have those set of tools.
And also as all of them are structured properly in data, either XML files, or we probably will move now into JSONs, but it's... you can basically assign them all over Grasshopper scripts or so. So you don't need to manually anywhere, but you say just, I don't know, okay, five shades of wood or I don't know. And it would go through the servers and it would...
So you guys made your own asset manager, basically.
Yes, in some way. But we are trying to integrate it into the... so people can access them in Grasshopper.
So basically, your assets are part of your. I mean, they're things that you can call through your parameterization in some way.
That's some way.
Really interesting. And so, how did? I mean, I don't. I usually. It's interesting because I usually don't talk about V-Raid on this podcast, but I'm actually curious about like how do you guys? I mean, do you guys use any of the V-Raid things like VR scene files to be able to transfer information back and forth, or does it basically just live update all the geometry and then V-Raid regenerates itself? I guess.
Yeah, like some people are using V-Ray Scene for our assets. For example, we didn't use V-Ray Scene and the normal V-Ray way of transferring because some of the colleagues just found it a little bit confusing. I mean, V-Ray, like the converter that you have is amazing. And it fully makes sense if you know what's going on in the background. But for some people, when they don't have any more the normal V-Ray standard material, but they have the BDRF, note, then it's suddenly confusing because the layout looks different.
Got it.
So, and also you have the V-Ray mesh, so you need to convert it again to OBJs and so on.
Okay.
So what we did is actually we have an internal converter who converts all our Mac stuff into native Maya.
Got it.
And now with Rhino V-Ray Next, you release the SDK, so I think we can finally manage to get also all our assets into Rhino and then maybe really have pure Grasshopper Rhino workflows.
That's awesome.
That's something that we are really looking forward to. But yeah, for now it's more like sending, exporting files in OBJs or custom data and then import them automatically in another software.
Right.
So that is for now not necessarily happening real life.
That's right. But you're looking into it.
It would be way easier, of course.
Got it. Now, you mentioned earlier, you know, you talked about using blend shapes, that it's an untraditional tool for architects to use. Is there certain parts of V-Ray or rendering in general that you guys use that is untraditional in the architecture world that you feel has benefited or used in your design process?
Something that helped us, for example, to keep certain parametric workflow, let's say in V-Ray, is a lot of these procedural textures or textures that work with data, like, for example, distant text. Because that helps us keeping, in some way, a parametric workflow. Because we then, I don't know, for example, in master plans, if you have a flower bed or something in the city, we don't necessarily need to make it as a geometry. We export a line or a face and then use the distant text to make actually the bed and multi-levels of it. So we can have it quite abstract of what we want to represent then in rendering. So I don't know if people are using necessarily that. Vertex colors we use a lot. Everything which can somehow work with data.
Right.
So, and that's really amazing.
That's true, because there's a lot of, you know, utility nodes in use, right? So distance texture or other weird things that you would use.
Dirt text and so on. So these are really powerful, and we really like to use them because it just let us keep working flexible, basically.
Interesting. Yeah, because they would update. Like, distance texture would update itself based on the distance of things.
Exactly.
And as the distance changes, it'll give you a new readout.
Exactly. So.
So you do you use some of the rendering process for your analysis process besides just does it look good? But do you do it for other analysis, like lighting analysis?
Yeah, that's, I think, something that now our design classes are looking at is into this new light meter. Light meter. So that's something they are super excited about.
Yeah.
So that's definitely, they will look into other things in combination with rendering and analysis.
Well,
it doesn't cross my mind now.
Yeah,
so fast.
I mean, I can talk of a little bit of a few smaller projects, things like receptions, where we've basically the guys that are the lighting the consultant, which is the expert, is actually the one that is doing the analysis and populates with the proper luminaires, right? So because we have the IES files, we have the locations of the luminaires, and they are pre-doing their analysis. Now what we have is that we have people working on the Rhino model for the design or Maya model in the design, the lighting consultant also consolidating this model on Rhino. And then what we do is we transfer that to Unreal Live. So what this allows, and using a real-time ray tracing. So what this allows you is to actually have a visual representation of what his luminaires look real time while he's making changes.
Right.
So what this really does is that we avoid this the in-between step, which is them going to produce a render where they have to tweak these values and start fudging a little bit the intensities.
Right.
We have it live on a VR model, on a real time model that allows us to interrogate this as the design is happening, right?
Right.
So when we do a very specific design, like a certain strip colors pink, for example, we're able to actually see how that looks in the space.
Right.
Right.
That's interesting. Okay, so you jumped into it. So let's talk about real time.
Yeah.
How has that changed in your process?
Well, it's great.
It's
basically. I mean, the group that looks into it specifically in the office is the VR group.
The VR group.
Yeah.
So the biggest demand, like the one that sort of focused on real time was the VR group.
It's
right?
The VR group. Yeah. I mean, we called it VR because,
Right.
It's but it kind of encompasses everything that's to do with augmented reality, virtual reality, just real time.
Sure.
Basically, gaming engines.
Right.
We've been using Unreal for the past 4.5 years or so.
Okay.
We try to make to go real time as quick as we can. But there's obviously or at least for the past 4 years, there've been always this step where you have to prepare your geometry specifically for that medium.
Yes.
That is an additional overload. So, and it's actually painful. It's a very painful overload.
Yeah.
So
it's over worse the than past,
them. Over the past, exactly. So over the past 4 years, we've developed a number of scripts that basically allows us to. I'll automate a little bit. I press the button in Grasshopper. Grasshopper creates UVs, creates
meshes. This is a theme with you guys.
We are lazy people. So we hate doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
So we invest twice the time, do a script, and then don't worry about it again. Now, obviously, the workflow is becoming easier and easier because Epic, for example, is lowering the entry bar for this, right? They're trying to put it in the hands of architects.
Sure.
Right? Not only game developers, which means that now things like... importing data from Rhino into Unreal is a lot easier now with Unreal Studio.
Okay.
We still prefer the hard way, which is basically our scripts for most of our cases because of our very specific geometry, right? So things like what Marco was mentioning, things like maintaining the flow of wood, for example, in a specific design, that is something that we like keeping and that our scripts allow us to maintain as we go to Unreal. So this creates the light maps UVs that allows us to pre-bake lighting and make sure that what we have is realistic to a certain extent.
Okay.
And that allows us to jump into VR relatively fast.
Right.
Well, VR or real time, depending on the design. And we're in love with the technology for ourselves, for designing, for us to be able to see our own designs, and the clients love it when you present it to them.
Right.
Yeah. It's still hard to get it into the hands of clients. I mean, I would have hoped that by now everybody knows what VR is and everybody would be keen to ask, for a VR model, but most clients are still you know, I've never tried it. Why am I going to pay so much for this, right?
Right.
Right. So you still have, there's still a convincing work to the client so that they are aware that this is something that is worth it, that is something worth investing from the beginning of the design.
Yep.
So that they can be basically receiving their design in VR. Yeah.
Also something, as we talked before, like regarding these two images, two states of the model, mm-hmm. something that real time helps us is actually to have probably a live demonstration of the parametrics, or even the client can literally like move a few sliders and see how his decisions might affect the design.
Yeah.
So that's something that we are looking for also to do in real time, to just have a small app that maybe summarizes a certain things for the client,
okay.
and then he can see, and that convinces him also that we are capable of adjusting our designs.
Right.
For whatever reason it would happen, if the budget, like if suddenly costs are increasing or something, so we need to adjust, or yeah, he doesn't own the land, or there are some other things.
I think that's fascinating, in the interactivity that you do with real time, because you're not going to take your client and say, here, jump into Maya, do your own design,
yeah.
you know. But if you give them a couple of sliders or something yeah. that makes it feel like they have a say in the design decision,
yeah.
it's a huge difference. We had back when I was doing commercials, we did a lot of car commercials, and we had some guy who developed a car simulator that was extremely physically mm-hmm. accurate car simulator. And so we didn't animate the cars, we would drive the cars.
Yeah.
We would drive them all the time. And then when you suddenly like try to do something that the client is saying, it's like, I want the car to do this, like, well, it's not physically possible for it to do that. And if we do that, it's going to look fake, right?
Yeah.
Because, and then it's like, you know what? Why don't you drive the car? It's completely safe. You're not going to get in, if you get in an accident, you just hit the reset button.
Yeah.
You know, you try to drive a car and you try to see what looks, and then they do that and they're like, oh, you're right, that's not going to work. But what
yeah.
if I do this? What if I do that? And then you make that decision together, but the client, you know, he or she will understand what
yeah.
the process is and feel invested more in the
yeah,
project.
Yeah, no, that definitely.
Yeah. yeah, that's a great idea about real time, is be able to use the interactivity to give something that enables them to feel like they're part of that process.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So also, let's we're getting actually pretty close, but it's, let's talk a little bit about ray tracing, real-time ray tracing. You guys, we mentioned that briefly.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your thoughts in that area.
Well, I mean, I want to know where we are.
Yeah.
I would like to see where we are a year from now, 2 years from now,
yep.
where when the hardware is basically in an even better state.
Sure.
The very little that we've actually tested, because we've only had the hardware for a couple of weeks now.
Right.
Yeah. So
RTX cards you're talking
RTX
about.
RTX cards. Yes. it has the potential to be a game changer, because it allows you, at least when you are in the design process and you are not looking for an end product that has to comply with a certain performance,
mm-hmm.
it allows you to immediately go in and you have a photorealistic, to a certain extent,
yeah.
Model, which is insane.
It's completely
right?
with your philosophy of
yeah.
like,
no.
show it, make it real from the beginning.
No.
The first
exactly.
vertex that's dropped, it's ray tracing.
More or less, yeah.
I mean, the reality is that that additional step of having to produce a light map set of UVs, it's a huge hassle
right.
during the design process, right? Like, you want to do it immediately. You don't want to have to produce all this. And being able to have ray tracing at the same time allows you to completely bypass that process.
Right.
To stop thinking about how you're faking the reflection so it looks more or less convincing,
sure.
right? Or occlusion, right?
Right.
Or GI. So being able to really have ray tracing, real-time ray tracing, it's a huge game changer.
Okay.
Of course, you've had, to an extent, something similar with, you know, like V-Ray RT and anything that has to
mm-hmm.
that has that sort of level of interactivity, but it's not the same as literally dropping a person a scale and navigating as if it was, you know, one-to-one scale. Or
right.
being able to put on a headset and be able to take a look at the space immediately.
Yeah, right. Especially being able to bypass the UV creation of the light maps is an advantage, because I don't know how many architects are really spending just with a normal texture UV mapping. And then if you need to tell them, hey, there is a second layer you need to also take care of, then
yeah.
for them it's, and if you can bypass at least one of them, that's already a huge advantage.
So when I was my first job in the visual effects world, I was working on Day After Tomorrow.
Mm.
Right.
Oh, nice.
And I had to
build all of New York. That's what I hired an architect, right, to do it. And so I could just like build, you know, not me. There was a team of us, but that was, you know, we're building huge buildings and buildings. So I was just modeling buildings all day long, but very detailed buildings in Maya, which is wasn't at that time very good for modeling buildings, but I could still bang out a very complex, Art Deco building in about a day. But then after about a day of doing the building, then I spent 3 days UVing the building, right? Yeah. Which is the worst part, because and if you have to tell an architect they've got to UV their building, that sounds horrible. And if you're rasterizing or using a game engine, you kind of have to do that, because to bake lighting, that's what you got to do.
Yeah.
So so this is basically brings where I'm trying to go, because there's a lot of misconception of real-time ray tracing of what that actually means. There's two kinds of ray tracing when it comes to real time. There's what a lot of people are seeing that looks beautiful in demos and it looks like, wow, that's ray tracing. It's not ray tracing. It's actually ray tracing effects, because you're actually rasterizing everything and then you're adding a little bit of ray tracing on top that gives it that extra realism that you're looking for. But full ray tracing right from the beginning, take RT and put it on steroids, right? It's not RT now, we're calling it V-Ray GPU. But take that and do full ray tracing, and then you don't have to worry about UVing and don't have to worry about doing light baking. You can just light it. That's the way it's gonna go.
We definitely can see a workflow where you're working in Rhino, streaming the geometry to your second monitor that is completely ray traced,
right,
where you only have a couple of HDRIs.
Right. Done.
And then that's it. Yeah. Done.
More or less, yeah.
And the real power of that is that, the reality is that us both, we are really keen into visualization.
Right.
We have an interest into making renders that look nice.
Right.
But not everybody in the field is interested in it.
Right.
Like a lot of people in our office are they're kind of thinking this is somebody else's task, right?
Right.
You know, I work in Rhino, and then after that, this is somebody else's problem.
Right.
And it would be great to have those people be able to interrogate the design on a completely real-time, beautifully looking, realistic-looking scene.
Right. Well, that's where Lavina is going to be.
Exactly. Yeah, we're super excited on any step in that direction.
Right.
Has us rubbing our hands.
Yeah,
because it is definitely, it's going to help us, ourselves.
Right.
But it's also going to help all these people that have no interest in this. It basically just makes them jump on board without any effort.
Right.
Yeah. Which is, they are the guys that we're going to get on board.
It's getting more interactive, like you said. They feel more involved in it.
Yeah, the designers do.
Yeah. In that case.
Which is really cool. That's really cool. Okay, well, that's been awesome. Thanks so much for doing this. How are you guys enjoying... this is only the first day of Total Chaos.
Yeah.
A lot more.
Well, we enjoyed last year. It was
you were here last year?
Yeah, it was really, really nice.
Yeah.
Meeting a lot of people, seeing what other people are doing.
Right.
So that was really cool. So definitely looking forward for
it's
the next days.
And we're here also to hunt some people.
Oh, hunting. Oh, you're doing some recruiting.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Of course. That's great. That's great. Well, can you mention quickly what your talks are going to be about?
Sure. So basically, we have a talk where Marco is going to be talking about... visualization. Mm-hmm. If you want to
yeah,
a
like
bit on that.
Some stuff that I now mentioned, like how to deal with a parametric workflow.
Yeah.
And I will also show the textile sculpture.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And also in general some tools and pipelines that we use. So mine is more visualization related or rendering related. And
you're going to be on the code track of things, or
no? We're actually on the art, so
yeah.
We need to keep it like
simple.
I mean, at the end of the day, we're still a design firm.
Yeah,
it's
of course.
Really our
but it sounds like you could be on either track.
Yeah, we thought that maybe we can show a little bit also the people that are not necessarily so much into code how you can with simple scripts how you can enhance your workflow.
Because got it.
A lot of stuff that we're showing is. You don't need necessarily a programming background, but some of the stuff you just watch a few tutorials on YouTube or whatever, and you can use it. And it can really help you also as a visualization company to meet maybe your deadlines easier.
Nice.
And so on.
And I'm going to be talking mostly about the BR work that the office has done over the past 4 years.
Right.
Which is also related in this sense, just like this, like being able to script just opens a huge amount of doors.
Right.
Including... enhancing VR and real time,
right?
Because basically that it is. I mean, it's not a required knowledge for playing with gaming engines, but it allows you to expand on what you can do with them infinitely.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, guys. This has been great having you guys here and to talk about this stuff. And
thank you, too.
Look forward to your talks. I think it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, thanks for having us.
Thanks.